Hi gang, Barry here, speaking to you in 2022 on our 250th episode week. This week we will be releasing the 250th episode of Worst Foot Forward. And it's pretty weird to think about the fact that we've been recording these dumb things for as long as we have and put as many down as we have. But that's not today's release. We have a whole birthday week of things planned for you. On Wednesday, our 250th episode will be released, and that is going to be a special episode with Ben and myself sharing all sorts of facts about birthdays and parties and cake and celebrations, and it'll be peppered by recordings of facts and stories from a whole bunch of past Worst Foot Forward guests who have been kind enough to contribute to it. And we'll also have a few facts sent in by you lot, our listeners, and it's going to be a big old hodgepodge and a nice chance to hear some old familiar friends again. And that's coming on Wednesday. And on Friday, we've got our traditional monthly bonus episode, The Third Foot. And this month, it's all going to be about the number 250. And that'll be Ben and I sharing some facts about that particular number. Ooh, facts about one number. It's bound to be a laugh riot. But today's episode is one that you've kind of picked for us. We put out a poll on Twitter a couple of weeks ago asking people what their favourite episodes were, what the episode was they would choose to introduce people to the podcast and so on. And a lot of you mentioned Worst Pirate, which is always a fan favourite. Board Game was mentioned as well. But this one came up again and again and again, the episode with Joel Morris, all about the world's worst musical film. So we're re-releasing that to mark our 250th episode week, which has been really nice, actually. This was originally released in October 2018. I think it was episode 93. So here we are, 157 episodes and nearly 4 years later. And it still sticks out to a lot of you. And it sticks out to Ben and myself as well. There's weird Mae West films. There's a Beatles film with the Bee Gees, and Ben takes us through the plot of Listomania, which makes Joel and I lose our minds. It's a really funny episode. Joel is a friend of the show. He was on our first live episode as well. You'll also hear him in the 250th episode. He contributes a very funny story about Tippex and a Henry James novel. And you're also about to hear him now. He has recorded a special little intro for this episode for the re-release, to tell you what he remembers about it and why he chose musical films and why they fascinate him so much. So it's going to kick off a bumper week of Worst Foot Forward content for you. We hope you enjoy revisiting this episode if it's one that you listened to when it originally came out, or we hope you enjoy hearing it for the first time if you're one of the whole bunch of new listeners we seem to have garnered in the last month, and you're slowly working your way back through the back catalogue. This is a gem. We hope you're enjoying Worst Foot Forward, and we hope it encourages you to keep nosying your way through the archive. We're both very proud, Ben and I, of the podcast and how far we've come, and it's really nice to go down memory lane with this particular classic episode of Worst Foot Forward. Happy birthday to us. You'll hear from us again on Wednesday. Now over to Joel Morris to lead us into the episode. Episode 93 of Worst Foot Forward, all about the world's worst musical film.
Hello, I'm Joel Morris, and I did a Worst Foot Forward about the worst musical film. Not films of a musical. They're good, like West Side Story, they're great. These are musical films, like sort of Rockstar Vanity Projects, which is a sort of horrible, stunted subsection of music and film. The worst of both, all together in one. And we talked about the Bee Gees in the Sgt. Pepper film, and Listomania, and an awful Mae West film, Sextet, and Harry Nilsson's awful Son of Dracula. They've usually got Ringo Starr in them. Whatever happens, he's your mark of, he's like a warning, like the stripes on a wasp. Don't go near a film starring Ringo Starr. But weirdly, the film that I remember most talking about was Paul McCartney's Give My Regards to Broad Street, and I'm a huge Paul McCartney fan, and I often joke that I will finish any book that features Paul McCartney, and I can't work out why they don't put him in all books, because then I definitely finish them all. If they put him in The Tenant of Wildfell Hall or Northanger Abbey, I definitely finish that. But I didn't manage to finish watching Paul McCartney's Give My Regards to Broad Street, even though I'd volunteered to do it, I'd chosen it, and it was for a podcast where I was supposed to talk about Give My Regards to Broad Street. But it's such a poor, poor film that I couldn't finish. I feel guilty about it now. I'm a fraud. I feel worried that Paul McCartney will find out that I didn't finish watching his film, even though I was watching it for work, for a job, that I promised to watch a film by my favourite musician, and I couldn't do it. And I think that's what's fascinating about musical comedy films, is that it doesn't matter if it's the greatest musician, a very creative person who I love, they will make a bad film, because these films are just very often very, very bad. Unless they're Slade in Flame, in which case they're amazing.
I had a theory about Andrew Lloyd Webber, that his entire career was like the producers.
Yeah.
That he'd started off, he'd gone, what would lose money? And they went, what about the Bible? Okay, we don't. What about doing the Bible again? What about doing right-wing dictators? What about everyone's dressed as cats? Everyone's a train. Like the Northern Ireland Trouble. I've got to lose money somehow. And they keep accidentally being hit.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. I am one half of your hosts, Mr. Ben Vanderveld. I don't know why I gave myself that honorific there, but since we're doing something vaguely theatrical, that seems appropriate right. This week. And it is time to put on a spectacular today. We're all tits and teeth, except after an accidental labelling issue, our tits are covered in toothpaste and our teeth are covered in tit tape. Meanwhile, the chorus line who we've hired for the opening number all fell ill, so we had to hire a Greek chorus instead, and they are failing to inject the necessary joie de vivre. Turns out it's hard to somersault whilst wailing and tearing your clothes. Worst of all, our producer has been caught nose deep in a pile of cocaine while snorting several hookers, and it looks like the money's going to dry up any time now. Still, at least we're a dead cert for the Razzies. And with me is the springtime to my Hitler, Barry McStay.
Man, I am so excited today. I've been dying for us to do a musical episode of some sort, and now it's finally going to happen.
I love it. Just occasionally, it's nice when you can conform to stereotypes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not the most gay of gay men.
Mate, I cannot wait to do World's Worst Currency. Oh, it's going to be terrific. Followed by World's Worst Interest Rate.
And World's Worst International Conspiracy. We've done that already, we've done that.
Yeah, we have done conspiracy theories. You know, when we did that, I don't think we mentioned the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
We've mentioned them enough in other episodes.
We should, yeah, but we're going to talk about the musical film industry, so they probably turn up in that instead.
To be fair.
Actually, Protocols of Elders of Zion, the musical.
I mean, it wouldn't be the worst topic for a musical there's ever been.
No, there's since going to the Edinburgh Festival, year on year, you can predict with alarming regularity will always be the biggest news event of last year, the musical.
Oh, yeah. Trump the musical was the big 2017.
And then Brexit the musical.
Brexit the musical, yeah.
God, do you think they're going to do Brett Kavanaugh's Confirmation the musical?
Really hope not.
My brother, you will. Like, Climate Change the musical.
They'll be set underwater, though. In a swimming pool or something.
Yeah, probably. Well, no, Climate Change the musical will, like, the producers will be like, yeah, we know we need to give you the funding. We know you do, and they never will.
Just with my lefty liberal hat on for a second, what year do you think that climate change is going to be the big news story? And will it be a few years too late?
Yeah, exactly. Certainly. It's going to be 2045 and bleak.
I'm going to introduce our guest. Our guest this week is a comedy writer who, alongside his partner Jason Hazley, has created some of the finest folly and frippery this country has seen in recent years. Among numerous TV credits, he's written for that Mitchell and Webb look and Charlie Brooker's Screen Wipe and Newswipe programmes, and puts the words in the mouth of that most savant of idiots, Philomena Kunk. He is a podcaster, regular contributor to Viz magazine, a co-founder of the Framley Examiner, a parody of local newspapers, and one of the writers of Bollocks to Alton Towers, a humorous guidebook to the United Kingdom. He and Hazley have also enjoyed widespread success as co-writers of the Ladybird Books for Adults series, of which, by my count, there are now 32, dealing with everything from hangovers to hipsters, red tape to the zombie apocalypse. Chances are, if you've laughed at something in the past decade, he might have had something to do with it. And writers don't usually get the credit they merit, but here he is, finally getting the recognition that he deserves, a fitting tribute to his work, an appearance on the 307th ranked comedy podcast in Qatar. That is not even a joke, folks.
You can't buy publicity like that.
It's Joel Morris.
Thanks for inviting me on.
You're going to be massive in Qatar now.
Yeah.
Like human rights abuses. Nope. Can we go? Can we go in 2022 to the World Cup in Qatar and just record from there?
What, a Jew and a gay in Qatar?
Yeah. Is this some kind of joke?
Yeah. Oh, we've nailed the title of the podcast.
Yeah, I can see the spin-off. Thanks for doing the show. You're a recommendation from one of our previous guests,
yes,
John Dryden Taylor,
who's an old friend.
Passed you our way.
Very kind of him. Yeah, he was my wife's best man at our wedding because we had two best men. Because
nice.
We worked out that bridesmaids don't really do anything. So we said everyone wants a best man. So yeah, he was a marvel at our wedding.
Yeah.
He sang, and everyone talked about his singing, and very few people talked about our wedding. He managed to, in true Broadway style, he stole the show.
He does Sondheim and stuff like that.
He did very complicated Sondheim. The two best men did it, and my best man, which was Jason, played the piano far too fast.
Yeah.
And I'm still recovering.
I'm trying to catch up. Wow.
Yeah. That happened at my wedding. I thought it'll be a great idea to, instead of a him, have the bare necessities.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a lovely idea, but it turns out the bare necessities, when you haven't rehearsed it and you have 100 of your family and friends trying to do it at once, it just, the melody falls over itself.
Yeah. And when you've got maybe only 10% of us know the full song the whole way through.
Yeah.
We always ask our guests what they are worst at in the world. What would that be for you?
I would, because I did this yesterday, I'm worst at returning a ball to a child in the park who's kicked it towards me. And I do it
specifically to children.
Yeah, and I do it now with my son with me, who looks at me in a way that goes, "Dad, you can return a ball, can't you?"
How old is your son?
He's 9, and he doesn't like football.
Oh, he's just at that sort of stage where he could be disillusioned at any moment.
And I kick back and I miss it, and it goes to my son who has to return it. I'm terrible because I tend to step up thinking, this time I'll be able to do it.
Yeah.
And it's actually, my childhood was based on reading Peanuts strips and thinking I was Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
And it is like Charlie Brown and Lucy with the ball.
Football,
and each time I approach it, going, this time I'll do it. And I miss. Very often, I did this once too. We used to work a lot before we had an office in the Festival Hall on the South Bank. Big public building, Wi-Fi, coffee, loads of people used to work there.
Yeah.
And they have big graduations there. Where all the graduands come in with their mortar boards and things, and they all celebrate.
Yeah, yeah.
And they throw their mortar boards in the air to celebrate things, to have photographs taken. And one of the days there, I was standing on the balcony at the Festival Hall, and some celebrating girl threw her mortar board up, and it landed next to me on the balcony. She said, "Can you throw it down again?" And I threw it onto an inaccessible rooftop. Just trying to drop it downwards.
Wow.
So I am so bad at returning things, and she obviously had hired that and then would have to go and pay for the full cost of the mortar board.
Are you the guy who managed to throw some guy's shoe onto those struts of the Hungerford Bridge?
Yeah, they're all me.
I don't know how they get there.
I don't know why I was supposed to be returning a shoe, but I cannot return a thing that has been thrown to me.
I love that you accidentally bullied a stranger.
I'll put your bag on the roof. I'll give you a bog wash.
Yeah.
What I like is that this is the most hopeful moment of this girl's life.
She's, yes.
And I went, this is how it's going to be.
Achievement, by class.
Hello, folks. Sorry to interrupt your podcast listening. It's Barry here, speaking to you from my hotel room in Dublin, with a very quick reminder that if you enjoy the stuff we're making, and hey, you've had about 7 minutes of it now, and I bet it's pure gold, then you can support us by visiting www.patreon.com/worstfootforward, where you can support us, ideally monetarily, in fact exclusively monetarily, by donating as little as a couple of quid a month, all the way up to I think 50 quid a month, to enable us to keep making podcasts, to help us grow it in ways such as researching a book, releasing an extra episode a month, and doing live shows. And in return for such wonderful beneficence on your part, you will get exclusive monthly content, the option of selecting a topic for an episode for us, even judging an episode or having us visit you in your very own home and doing a show for you in person in your sitting room. Please provide biscuits. I subsist entirely on biscuits. So that's patreon.com/worstfootforward, where you can find out all about that. Now, back to Joel, or me, or Ben, whichever of us is about to speak now.
Musicals, Ben.
Yes,
indeed. Oh, what's your big number? 5, 6, 7, 8.
So yeah, we're going to be very specific. We're doing musical films this week, because musical theatre is a whole other world of batshittery, which will probably take hours and hours and hours.
I think that's going to be a 2 or 3 part episode.
Yeah, almost certainly. It'll be the Angels in America. Angels in America a musical?
No, it's a play, but it is in 2 parts. It's quite lengthy.
Yeah, it sounds like it should be
Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. It'll be impossible to get tickets for, and you won't be sure that your child will enjoy it enough to spend £500.
And you might get shat on with an owl.
It is really good.
I'm told that, but also my child, who really wants to go and see it, will be bored.
Well, it's fine. They don't hand out ice cream in the interval, just Red Bull and amphetamines.
Butter beer and some sort of inexplicable sweet that makes you explode. Yeah. Wizards are fucking stupid, guys. Yeah. I've been waiting to get this out of this for a long time. Why do your books eat you? What is wrong with you? You've got broomsticks. Why do you need a fucking steam train? I've just finished watching all the films again. Yeah. Everything about this is ridiculous.
And you've decided to take down the infrastructure.
Yes.
That's what you're going for. Why did you decide to pick worst musical film?
I do really like musicals. The really interesting thing is, I think, is they're a bit like children's books in that people think they're easy because they're very often, the best ones are very simple. The stories are supposed to be simple, broad strokes, big characters, and you get lots of songs, so you need to write half the film, the rest of it can be songs. And what people don't realise is that that makes them harder, not easy.
Yeah, people sometimes think songs are easy.
Musical film is very, very easy to do badly, and also something like the celebrity children's book that people who shouldn't be allowed to make musical films very often go, I'll make a film, but I won't make The Godfather. I'll try and make Grease.
Yeah.
And you go, you know they're equal. Difficult. Very often musicals that people like are done, you could argue they're not done brilliantly, because I think it's really difficult. They're masterpieces of editing and assembly how you use a song to move plot forward is very difficult. So I think in terms of bad films, there are lots of bad musicals and they will make all the mistakes.
Yeah.
In the same way as people used to, when they used to have those Golden Raspberry Awards, there was lots of science fiction in there. Because it turns out science fiction's quite hard.
Yeah.
It's quite easy. With no budget, you can make horror okay.
Yeah.
But it turns out with no budget, it's quite hard to make Doctor Who.
Yeah.
It turns out that you think Doctor Who's got a low budget, you try and make it, it's really difficult. But yeah, it's quite easy to make them badly, and I think they fall so short of what their potential was. Yeah, so I thought we'd do those.
Brilliant. Okay, Barry, off you go. You're going to lead us in with the opening number.
Sure. Let's have a little quiz, first of all.
Sweet.
Can you name the 10 musicals that have won the Oscar for Best Picture or Outstanding Film?
Oh,
yeah,
Singing in the Rain?
No.
Ooh, that is a travesty.
Yeah. The Sound of Music.
The Sound of Music did, yeah.
West Side Story.
West Side Story did.
Chicago?
Yes, Chicago did.
Did Chicago win?
Yes, it did in 2002.
Very well edited.
Mate, it's the year after 9/11. Of course a musical won the Best Film.
Okay, what other famous...
A couple of really famous ones.
Jiggly?
Gigi did.
Gigi, not Jiggly.
Yeah, not Jiggly with Ben Affleck.
They put songs in it. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
And...
Do you want more?
Yeah, go on.
Do I want more? Oh, Oliver!
Oliver did. Yeah, really grim, sad musical in the year of all the assassinations in 1968. Another big bad event, 1963, the assassination of Kennedy. So naturally, 1964, my Fair Lady won.
Oh, of course it was.
I'm loving this theory, like, that when Trump gets in for his third term and abolishes the Constitution, the musical that wins the Academy Awards the next year is going to be breathtaking.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be stunning.
I reckon Parker and Stoner is lining up.
Yeah. Yeah. The others are An American in Paris.
One.
Going My Way, which is a Bing Crosby vehicle, which has songs like Swing on a Star and things like that. The Great Ziegfeld, which is about the Ziegfeld Follies on Broadway.
Yeah.
And 1928-29, Broadway Melody, which is essentially just a Broadway review, but on a film, which is a big event.
It's the equivalent of the Footlights winning the first ever Edinburgh Comedy Award.
Oh, this is what sound on film looks like. It was that. So, 1927, the jazz singer was famously the first feature to actually include spoken dialogue in it.
Yep.
Previously, there had been films with sound in it. There'd been some shorts and there'd been some features that had sort of synced soundtracks and sound effects, but this is the one that had synced musical numbers and a little bit of synced dialogue. Only about 2 minutes of it.
Yeah.
There's not a huge amount in it.
Oh, really?
And the first vote, it's a
dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
There's 12 minutes of dinosaurs in Jurassic Park.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot.
Your big selling factor. It's less is definitely more, isn't it?
So the jazz singer, it's a story about a young Jewish... It's about a Jewish boy whose dad wants him to be a... He's a cantor in a college. His dad wants him to be a singer at the synagogue. And instead he wants to be a jazz singer. And he's played by Al Jolson. And he sort of runs away from home, if you like, and becomes a big jazz singer, but blacks up for the role and stuff. It's the 20s, it's Al Jolson, guys, different times. The first vocal performance isn't actually until 15 minutes into the film. And he sings a song called Dirty Hands, Dirty Face, appropriately enough.
Wow.
And then at 17 minutes and 25 seconds, immediately after the song, the first spoken line comes in and he says, wait a minute, you ain't heard nothing yet. Which sounds like it's a really good gag written for the fact that he's speaking for the first time, but actually... It's a bit of established stage patter that Al Jolson used to say quite a lot. He came on stage at a World War I concert in 1918, celebrating the end of the war, following the great opera singer Caruso, and came on saying, wait a minute, you ain't heard nothing yet. Like, he's about to come out and top Caruso as a gag. And then he released a song in 1919 called You Ain't Heard Nothing Yet. It cost quite a lot of money to make, but in the making of it, Harry Warner stopped taking a salary. He pawned some of his own jewellery. He moved his family to a smaller apartment to try and make sure the film got made.
Is this because it's a technological leap forward? This is one of those things like Snow White and the Seven Dwarves or Jurassic Park, where you're trying a new technology and everyone's going, well, this might just go tits up. This could be Tron.
Yeah, well, it's a real feat. So it's the film ran at 89 minutes, but it concluded 15 reels of film.
Wow.
That's what, a reel every 6 minutes or so?
Yeah.
And 15 discs of sound as well. So the guys running it reel to reel and getting swapping the discs over.
Cinemas it could
exactly, that was the thing. It was a sort of a travelling, there were only a few places it could be released. Sadly, Sam Warner, one of the four Warner Brothers, had died the previous day before the premiere.
Yeah, there were four Warner Brothers.
There was Harry
Harpo, Groucho,
Yakko, Wakko, and Dutch.
Yeah, yes!
Harry, Albert, and Jack L. And then, Sam had died. So the family had all gone back to California for the funeral. The crowd were really impressed with it. They were chanting Al Jolson's name. They were applauding after every song. And it wasn't a great movie. Critics were a bit like, meh, it's not anything apart from the fact that this is really cool. The technology and Al Jolson's performance were the bit that kind of saved it. And one critic even sort of suggested, he did the whole I don't think it'll last sort of thing. He said the jazz singer was one of the few subjects that would lend itself to the use of the Vitaphone, which is the technology we're using. So he said, because it was about singing, that made sense that they would have sound in this film. Otherwise, I can't really understand why they would.
That's brilliant.
The first Oscars were in 1929, I think, but they were for films from 1927 and 28. And it was ruled unfair that the jazz singer would be included because it was up against completely silent films.
Right, so it's a different...
It's a different genre.
Yeah, different art form.
Yeah, they gave it a special award, I think, but they didn't allow it to be.
Because they did the same thing for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It got a special Academy Award, which was the Seven Little Oscars.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
I didn't know that.
It's because they said it's unfair to put it up against other things. It's not the best picture, but my God, we've just seen a new art form.
It's very different, yeah. There was a 1952 remake with Peggy Lee and, as a bigger travesty, a 1980 remake with Neil Diamond.
That's the classic one.
And Laurence Olivier.
The Dream Team!
Yeah. Weirdly, Neil Diamond is nominated for both a Golden Globe and a Golden Raspberry for this role. He won the Razzie.
That's like, I remember going to see Con Air at the cinema and coming out and saying that is either the best film or the worst film I've ever seen. I think it's both.
Yeah. That's basically all of Nicolas Cage's career.
Yeah. As you go, well, I've never seen anything like it.
It's weirdly, it's still got the jazz singer and he does not sing jazz.
Yeah.
It's still Neil Diamond singing the soft rock Neil Diamond does. 4 minutes into the film, a friend of his who is black is arrested for stealing a car, and the three other black members of his band are like, Neil, will you step in and play his instrument? So Neil Diamond in 1980 blacks up to play in a black club in New York.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh God.
Singing this really crap song.
You forget how late blacking up was on things.
Yeah. Oh,
before
no,
it was retro or orange.
To be fair, he was working with Olivier probably said it was fine.
Yeah.
Would you like to use my own polish?
Yeah. Someone in the front row notices that Neil Diamond has forgotten to black up his hands and says, that ain't no brother, it's a white boy. That guy who says that line is Ernie Hudson.
Oh, from Ghostbusters.
From Ghostbusters.
That's a superb piece of trivia.
Yeah, mass brawl breaks out. I'm going to jump forward about 30 years. Briefly mentioned South Pacific. Have you seen the South?
No, all anyone's seen of South Pacific is the newsreaders on Morecambe and Wise.
Yes, yes.
That's the only thing anyone knows about South Pacific.
Yeah.
Everyone pretends they've seen South Pacific because they've seen that.
Yeah. The most noticeable thing about it is, and you will notice it, guys, is every time a song comes up, these coloured filters come on the screen.
Ooh.
But they're way too strong. So it's like they wanted sepia tones, and there's one.
Is it just an orange filter?
There's one magenta filter that comes in, and you're like, I can't even see the pictures behind this anymore. It's so bad. It's like a really overpowering acid trip.
Is it like that brief period where everyone put those really complicated retro filters and all the photographs on their phone?
Yes.
And
yeah,
then you look back at your photos
and
go, why the fuck did I do that?
See any
now,
of this?
Yeah, it appears to be a blurry 70s photo of people from 2011.
Yeah.
God, this is stupid.
There's a character, an actor called Ken Clark, is sort of Hollywood B-movie performer who plays a character, Stew Pot, he's the deep voice in There's Nothing Like a Dame. The guy who's voicing him, because most of the singers are dubbed, is a guy called Thurl Ravenscroft.
Who is the voice of Tony the Tiger.
Yes, he bloody is.
Yes,
he's the voice of Tony the Tiger. For
he's
about
great.
50 years, he was that guy.
I love that your research is making the most batshit crazy connections.
I know. There's a line between Rodgers and Hammerstein and Tony the Tiger.
Thurl Ravenscroft is one of those names you hear once and go, that's going in the bank. Yeah. Can't fit Thurl. His name sounds like a tiger.
Yeah. Carousel's reviews were, it's great. I'm going to tell you a couple of facts about Mamma Mia 2 as well before I talk about
which I haven't
film.
Seen.
I've seen... Listen, they're not the best films in the world. The plots are very flimsy. Yeah. But if you like a bit of ABBA and you like seeing people dance and sing around in some sunny climes.
I used to work in the Tricycle Cinema in Kilburn, and I had to sit in and watch Mamma Mia about 25 times in 7 days. Yeah. And that felt like my Guantanamo Bay moment.
I went to see it with John Dryden Taylor, who you had on, and at 4 a.m, my wife woke up to find I wasn't in bed, tiptoed along the corridor and found me in my office asleep, like I'd sleptwalked. Mm. And I was sitting at my desk typing with the computer switched off. I said, what are you doing? And I went, I'm fixing it. And she said, what are you fixing? I went, the script, it just doesn't work. No one knows who Colin Firth's character is. They keep restating the stakes again and again and again. And she had to calm me down, pull me out of the dream state. She went, it's okay. It's come out. It's been a huge success. And she said, and you no one cares. And it was a really, really valuable lesson in writing. No one cares.
Mamma Mia 2 is the first sequel that Meryl Streep has ever been in.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's the first sequel of her career. Cher plays Meryl Streep's mum. She is 3 years older than Meryl Streep.
And looks younger. Thanks to surgery.
And Jeremy Irvine plays the young Pierce Brosnan. Weirdly, he played the young Colin Firth in the film The Railway Man.
What?
So he just needs to play the young Skarsgård, whichever one of the Skarsgårds it is, in another film, and he'll have completed the hat trick.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but I am going to lay into, and I'm sure Ben will agree with me on this, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Hooray!
Have you seen this film?
No, I have avoided
it.
Oh, man. I've been
told it's quite a thing. So, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is a 1978 film.
Mm-hmm. The perfect time to do it.
Yes.
at the height of punk. It should go down well.
And I'm quoting from Wikipedia here, a loosely constructed story of a band as they wrangle with the music industry and battle evil forces bent on stealing their instruments and corrupting their hometown of Heartland. It's not good. It's done in the form of a rock opera. It draws songs, basically pretty much all of Sgt. Pepper Bar 2 songs and most of Abbey Road. To his eternal shame, George Martin is the musical director of the film. And it stars as the lead actor, Peter Frampton.
Yes.
Yeah, alongside his sidekicks, the Bee Gees. Frankie Howard plays an evil villain.
Oh, come on.
Donald Pleasance plays a weird Hollywood executive. Aerosmith, Alice Cooper, Steve Martin, Earth, Wind and Fire. They're all in it. Robin Gibb said, there is no such thing as the Beatles now. They don't exist as a band and never perform Sgt. Pepper live in any case. When ours come out, it will be, in effect, as if theirs never existed, which is the stupidest thing to say before you release a shit film.
I already have deep issues with the Bee Gees.
Yeah. I think they'll sink a lot lower over the next couple of minutes.
Oh, God.
So, let me tell you...
Can I say I really like the Bee Gees? I'm aware as well that whenever I published a book, the first thing our publisher has said is, have you referred to the Bee Gees in the book? And we have to go through, because they will sue.
Yeah.
And the great thing about the Bee Gees is they are the touchiest people in the world.
Oh, as Clive Anderson learned.
It's genuinely brilliant. I think they're fantastic.
To be fair, George Harrison said that making this film, it's just like the Beatles trying to do the Rolling Stones. The Rolling Stones can do it better.
Yeah.
So the Beatles have nothing to do with this film, apart from being their songs that have been stuck into it.
Will this be to do with the fact that their songs belong to ATV...
Yeah,
music.
It's so Apple, one of the producers of
they
it.
They didn't
yeah.
own a lot of their music, so basically another publisher would put it out. So
Completely. And so Peter Frampton plays the main character, Billy Shears, the grandson of the original Sgt. Pepper. And so Sgt. Pepper had this band that cheered the town up during the war and through the decades, and they had magical musical instruments, and now the band has retired or died. Shears leads a band which is comprised of the Hendersons, who are the Bee Gees, and himself. His girlfriend is called Strawberry Fields. They band sort of get picked up and brought to Hollywood to meet a record producer played by Donald Pleasance in a bad toupee called BD. He has a band called Lucy and the Diamonds, seduce them. Yeah, it's bad on every level. Seduce them and sort of ensnare them in a den of vice in Hollywood. There are so many bad guys in this film, by the way, because then evil Mr. Mustard shows up in Heartland, played by Frankie Howard, in a van.
He's mean, Mr. Mustard.
Yeah, well, And Frankie Howard basically steals all the magic musical instruments from Heartland, and the town descends into vice and decay. By the way, he has robots for some reason. He answers to a mysterious shadowy villain called FVB. Strawberry sets off and gets the band back together and goes, we need to retrieve the musical instruments. But they've been disseminated to more villains. They're like, we've got to retrieve our trumpet from Dr. Maxwell Edison. They sing fucking Maxwell's Silver Hammer in this film.
You've got to find room for that.
Oh, it's sung by Steve Martin at peak Steve Martin speaking singing voice, doing a weird, like, bad tryout to play the dentist in Little Shop of Horrors half a decade later. God. It's one of the worst things. I love Steve Martin, genuinely, but if this was the only thing I'd ever seen of Steve Martin, I think I would curse him to all eternity. It's the weirdest. He plays an evil anti-aging specialist.
What?
They also have to steal a tuba from an evil cult leader, Father Son, played by Alice Cooper, who might get a shout out in Joel's bit as well. They're going to put together a benefit concert and rejuvenate the town, during which another villain, Peter Frampton's evil stepbrother Dougie, played by Paul Nicholas, the first Jesus Christ superstar,
oh my god,
plans to steal the profits from the concert. Mustard kidnaps Strawberry Fields. You're trying to keep track of all the villains. She kidnaps his girlfriend and Dougie in his van, and they're chased by Billy and the Hendersons in the town's hot air balloon. The town has a hot air balloon, guys.
The town has a hot air balloon.
Didn't someone say, someone's theory was never trust a film containing a hot air balloon?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's generally, I would say probably Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, it's okay. Yeah. Last Refuge of a Scoundrel is a hot air balloon.
That is a wonderful piece of niche writer's advice. Yeah.
Billy and the Hendersons locate Strawberry and Dougie in the lair of FVB, which turns out it stands for Future Villain Band, played by Aerosmith.
That's good, evil
band.
They played a really good villains band next door in the house next door to Run DMC, didn't they?
During a fight, Strawberry pushes Steve Tyler off stage but falls with him, and both of them die, and she dies very sad. Billy tries to commit suicide after her funeral and is saved by Heartland's magic weather vane, played by the singer Billy Preston.
I wasn't expecting the words played by after magic weather
vane. It looks like I'm sort of a majorette, and he's walking around the town singing Get Back while turning the baddies into things like bishops and monks, turning Mustard's van into a VW Beetle, restoring Strawberry to life. Yay! Strawberry Fields is actually forever. And turns the band's suits into some sort and Pepper uniforms, and they all, with all the inhabitants of the town, they do a sort of a Sergeant Pepper's cover album shot, and they sing a disco version, jabbing a pen into my thigh as I say this, of Sergeant Pepper. The cover includes Dame Edna, Frankie Valli, Carol Channing, Donovan, Minnie Riperton, Tina Turner, and Barbara Dixon. It's the most 70s Sergeant Pepper album.
It's like a Muppet Show guest list.
Who's the casting director for this? Gonzo.
To really nail how terrible the plot is, how they desecrate all of these songs, and particularly watch the Steve Martin version of Max Silverhammer, because it's a terrible song being butchered. I don't know what. It's like a car crash, and then someone has dumped nuclear waste on top of the car crash. And just to really nail how incomprehensible the plot is, the DVD, the Blu-ray trailer for it on YouTube just shows the songs and doesn't even have a voiceover trying to explain what the plot is.
But I think that's an essential thing with a lot of these rock vanity things. And you think, since no one's enjoying the story, why is there so much of it? if it's a musical and you go, oh, we've got the songs of the Beatles, either people have turned up for the music, in which case, as much as possible.
Yeah.
But the last thing I want to watch is people dressed as goblins and weather vanes and things and a rock band.
Where they've converted all the rock songs to disco.
Just in case.
Just to be really sure.
Fix the Beatles.
Yeah. The saddest little cherry on top is you watch the final shot as they're all singing the disco version of Sgt. Pepper, and they all look like they're really happy with what they've done. They all look like, this is gold.
People forget this as well, is that if you're involved in making anything, everyone thinks that when you're making a stinker, you know it's a stinker.
Yeah,
and when you're making a good thing, you know it's a good thing. And no one knows until it's finished, as Brian Eno said, any art is a phone conversation. Until someone picks up the other end, it's not finished.
It's the same with making comedy, and I didn't realise it works in other creative arts. Like, you can write down something and go, this isn't the greatest 5 minutes of comedy I've ever written. And as soon as you put it in front of literally one human, you're like, oh, these are just sentences. Not even good ones.
Thankfully, the Bee Gees did realise later on. They regained control of their back catalogue later in their careers, yeah. and they didn't bother with the soundtrack to this film.
Wow. yeah. And they are rapacious.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't stand between a BG and their royalties. Yeah. There were some bad musical films. The first one I was going to talk about, which I suggested to you, was Sextet, yeah. which is a terrific.
It's poor.
Which connects, there's some Beatles connection, Ringo Starr's in it, Alice Cooper's in it. And Sextet is a 1978 film, I think. It's a Mae West vehicle. It's the last film Mae West ever made.
She's in her 80s.
And she's 85. She was born in the 19th century. She made a film in the heyday of punk. And it's directed by Ken Hughes, who directed Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Yes.
And also directed The Small World of Sammy Lee, which is genuinely one of my favourite London gangster films with Anthony Newley. Yeah. He's a really... The shocking thing about all these films when they're bad is that the people involved knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
It's a different quality you get when someone is amateurish, but very often they're terrific filmmakers or terrific cinematographers, great musicians.
Yeah.
Everyone's working their hardest. Mae West plays the biggest film star in the world called Marlowe Manners, and yeah. she turns up in London to marry Timothy Dalton, and the whole film is based on the idea that everybody in the world wants to fuck Mae West.
At 85 years old.
Yeah, she does all the old lines that she used to do when she was in her prime.
Why didn't you come over and see me sometime?
She does that. See, stuff, you yeah. wait for those lines, and she's constantly in motion. She is jiggling almost yeah. constantly and in soft focus. Shot counter shot is just, they might as well be on different planets. There's a very thick atmosphere around. She is Vaseline to the most ludicrous degree.
Basically, you're looking at Mae West in a zoo for an hour and a half.
Yeah,
and you wait for the next celebrity to walk in.
People, I mean, it's got everyone in it. It's got Timothy Dalton, Dom DeLuise, Tony Curtis, Ringo Starr, Keith Moon, George Hamilton, and Alice Cooper. Yeah. When Alice Cooper appears, it's one of the most astonishing things ever. I don't think Alice Cooper knows he's in this film.
Yes.
He's either on so many drugs that he has no idea in it, or he's come off the drugs and has no idea he's in it. He's not got his makeup on. He just sits as a bellboy and plays the piano.
Yeah.
There's lots of dancing. There's lots of naked men. The US gymnastics team are in it. It's basically, Mae West wrote this as a stage play, and then it's a vanity project for, I imagine, in kind of the way that Madonna will do one of these at some point.
Yeah. You can imagine it kind of working as a stage play, because it's camp and silly, yeah.
And it's just songs that Timothy Dalton and her sing Love Will Keep Us Together. It
yes.
reminds me a lot of Mamma Mia.
I love that that's what they sing.
But it reminds me of Mamma Mia in the sense you're watching Hollywood stars go through the motions doing it, and it makes no sense. It's got a slight sort of whiff of Adam West Batman 60s camp to it that comes through. But the weird thing about this is I have watched Sextet about 5 times, and I really enjoy it. You know, a ghost is like Will without body, as in it's still performing the same actions after it's
yes.
died.
Yes.
That's what Mae West is in this. She's still being sexy after death.
Yeah.
She's so erotically charged that she survived the death of her body and a libido. And the film's been made around the star quality of that astonishing vavaboom sexuality that she does. She's still got it. And the thing that's
But she's basically blind and deaf in it.
Yeah, she's sort of strapped into these dresses and things. But what it is in a way that you will still strap Harrison Ford into a corset or yeah. William Shatner into a corset and say, you can still be a masculine hero.
Yeah.
It's one of the first times I've ever seen a female Hollywood star
yeah.
still do her shtick, which was sexiness,
mm-hmm.
way after she should have done it. And the suspension of disbelief is, can you join in the game that says she's still a viable, sexy woman?
Yeah.
And actually, it's kind of fun to watch. Who the hell would let a woman make a film like this? She's got the star quality and the pull to do it. So weirdly, yeah. Sextet is objectively a terrible film.
Yeah. So my other favourite thing about it is that she has earpieces hidden in her hairpieces to have her lines fed to her. So it's yeah. got this weird...
No one's
thought to edit the pauses out in the film.
She waits a second before feeding it. And everyone's trying their best. And it's really enjoyable.
Yeah.
It is a terrible film, but you can get to the end of it without noticing it. So I thought, that cannot possibly be a bad...
No, yeah.
That was my first thought. And I thought, I'll go deeper. And I thought, I will watch a couple of film musicals that I have never watched because I'm so frightened about how bad they are. And I will choose things that I genuinely want to watch. So I found it on YouTube. I watched Harry Nilsson's Son of Dracula. And I am the biggest Harry Nilsson fan in the world. I love Harry Nilsson, who sang Without You.
Yes.
It was his big hit. But I just love Harry Nilsson. He was regarded as the fifth Beatle. He's an American guy. The Beatles talked for a while about getting him in to replace Paul McCartney, and Paul McCartney walked out.
Really?
Yeah, he was just... I mean, Nilsson is just one of my favourite. He did Midnight Cowboy, Everybody's Talking.
Yeah.
Lovely,
yeah.
Terrific five-octave voice. Wrote loads of the hits for the Monkees.
Yeah.
And he ended up hanging out and getting very, very drunk during the very dark years with his best mates with John Lennon, Ringo Starr, Keith Moon. He was part of a set of heavy drinkers in LA called the Hollywood Vampires. Alice Cooper was part of them.
Mm.
So he's part of that gang who made Sextet. And he made one film, and it's an Apple film, which is produced by Ringo Starr, and it's called Son of Dracula. It's supposed to be a horror comedy, but I counted one joke in it. And the joke is that he plays a vampire called Count Down. That is genuinely the only joke in it. I watched.
Yeah,
it.
How many times did you have to watch it to spot that joke? Though?
They keep saying. But he plays in 1972. Nielsen made an LP called Son of Schmilson. He'd had a huge hit with Without
Son of Schmilson.
He'd had a huge hit with Without You, which is on probably his best album, which is called Nielsen Schmilson, which has got Without You on it.
It's a terrible title.
Best album cover of all time, which is him out of focus in a dressing gown at a fridge. It's one of my favourite images. That's why he's my favourite rock star. He's just barely woken up, and this is a huge hit. So he followed up with this album called Son of Schmilson, where he's on the front of it dressed as a vampire. And and Ringo Starr played on that album. And a couple of years later, Ringo comes to Harry and says, oh, we make films at Apple. I've got this idea of making a horror film about Dracula. And Nielsen said yes, thinking it was based on his album. And Ringo later on said, I didn't know his album was about Dracula. And Harry said, but you played on it. Yeah. And Ringo was so drunk at the time, he hadn't remembered. But he got him to be in the thing. And the script for this is written officially by someone called Jay Fairburn. And that's the pen name of an actress called Jennifer Jane. And she was a B-movie actress, and she was in a film called The Trollenberg Terror, which is a classic 50s sci-fi British black and white B-movie about a big eye with tentacles that crawls out of a cloud in the Swiss Alps. The film Son of Dracula is so bad that when I found out that it was written by the woman from The Trollenberg Terror, I was 12 minutes into Son of Dracula when I found that out, and I just pulled up The Trollenberg Terror on YouTube and watched 40 minutes of that. And I was 40 minutes into one of the worst films ever made when I realised I was watching that to avoid watching Son of Dracula. Son of Dracula is a musical film made by members of the Beatles starring my favourite rock star of all time, and it is unwatchable.
Wow.
It is so boring. And the thing it has in common with all bad musicals is it's got some rock songs in it and things and some good tunes, and they're some of my favourite songs. And they're played by an amazing scratch band. Count Down, the vampire, is in a rock band with John Bonham on drums. It's just a good band. And you're watching this band play in Soho dens and things, and you go, this is great. But between that, there's this awful story about Ringo Starr, who plays Merlin, who's dressed up as a wizard. And Ringo Starr is not a man you want to be delivering exciting exposition in anything.
No.
He's a limited acting.
I think of all the Beatles, Ringo's the one who definitely thought, yeah, I could be an actor.
Yeah, because he's good in Hard Day's Night.
Yeah.
And you forget, he's good in Hard Day's Night playing Ringo. But he gets to deliver. There's a brilliant, Freddie Jones plays Baron Frankenstein in this. Toby Jones' dad, great horror actor. And he comes in very early in Son of Dracula, to deliver the line, the air is already electric with excitement. And Ringo, dressed as a wizard, says, the representatives of the netherworld will soon be gathering to pay homage to their new king. And you go, I don't want to watch this film.
Why have you given Ringo like 5-syllable words?
And also, why is he saying the thing that's meant to be dramatic? Give that to the Christopher Lee guy. Give it to the guy from Hammer.
Also, representatives is never a creepy word, is it?
Hello, we're the representatives of the netherworld. We just want to lay the groundwork before the elders arrive.
You're thinking of the word denizens, aren't you?
Yes.
It's just... Ringo delivers all his lines as if he's ordering a takeaway. Probably baked beans, but it's terrible. And the whole thing about it is that these are people, the Hollywood vampires were legendary drinkers and hellraisers. But they're not even drunk.
Yeah.
And I watched it and went, oh, they're delivering all the lines efficiently. And what you've got is these huge gaps between the songs. And at the end of every song, this reminded me of Mamma Mia, someone then says, we must assemble the denizens of the underworld, for he needs to be crowned. And you go, right, okay, and they go off and do that. Then there's a song, and then someone says, the denizens of the underworld will be here soon, because you've forgotten, because the song wasn't about what the plot was. They keep restating the stakes. When I first went to see Mamma Mia, that was the thing that drove me mad.
Yeah.
Is an hour and 20, and she went, oh, my fathers will be here in a minute, I have to decide which one it is. And you're going, you said that at the beginning. So obviously what we've not done is moved the plot on at all.
Yeah.
And any of these jukebox musicals, the hard thing is there's no narrative in the songs.
Yeah.
It's not got the excuse of being a live concert film. It's meant to be a horror film. It's directed by Freddie Francis. But the plot doesn't get started because he keeps stopping for Harry and Ringo to do a song, which is nothing to do with the plot. It's structurally, it's the longest hour and a half I've ever spent watching something. It's just, there's one...
Sounds like it could be dealt with in a short film.
It's a pop video, it's a thriller.
Yeah.
It's what's strange about it. There's a great bit where Harry, who's great on camera, very charismatic and very sort of laid back, as he could have done this well. He wanders around Piccadilly Circus in the 1970s, all these lights.
Yeah.
And at some point, the full screen is filled with a flashing neon sign that says, this superb musical. And you go, don't put that on screen. Not in the middle of this. don't. It's a film where Harry Nilsson legendarily didn't perform live. He was a studio musician. And this contains film of him performing live, of which there is almost none. And even then, I was bored. And so I watched this and I thought, that must be the worst musical ever. So I thought, what I'll do after this is watch the other one I've avoided watching, which I watched, Give My Regards to Broad Street. Paul McCartney's 1984 rock musical that's got No More Lonely Nights in it. And I don't even want to talk about now, Son of Dracula never came out on DVD or VHS. Apparently, Ringo has a copy of Son of Dracula, or had one on top of his telly for years, and couldn't face watching.
Oh, no.
And given my regards for Broad Street, I had to get off a dirty pirate site because it never been released on DVD. The idea that something containing Beatles songs, that it would not be milked for every penny and put out on DVD, it's not worth it. It's, what's amazing is the Beatles, who are this astonishing musical force, have made some of the worst, or been involved in some of the worst musical films of all time.
We have talked about this before, because we did World's Worst Beatles Song in our current ever episode, and for all the great stuff they did, there is a lot of
If you look at Magical Mystery Tour and the angle, I might quite like it, it's whimsical, and as Mark Lewison beautifully pointed out, don't get angry with Magical Mystery Tour, it's more Beatles. I'd rather have more Beatles than less Beatles, but it's not good, it's shambolic. And you think these guys have got a great imagination, they're good storytellers, but the limits of their powers are limited by those songs you love and the records you do. And you realise the limits of their talents every time. Give my regards to Broad Street. Has the same problem as all these movies, in that it has a single bit of peril at the beginning. The denizens of the netherworld must gamble. And in my regard to Broad Street, Paul McCartney's in the back of a taxi cab at the beginning, and he gets a call to say that the master tapes of his new album have been stolen and they've got to find them. And then he falls asleep, which tells you how exciting those stakes are. And the rest of the film is a dream he has in the back of a taxi. So it's inconsequential immediately. Nothing happens. He dreams he goes to board meetings and rehearsals. He has a computer-controlled car that tells him his day, and the day is meeting, television meeting, rights meeting. They went, wow. He could go to the moon. He's dreaming.
This is like the episode of Knight Rider when nothing happens.
Yeah, the mission is to go and pick up your laundry. And he does it, and it's witless. It has no jokes in it. And you go, these are not stupid people. They're creative people. But given the opportunity to work in a medium you think they'd be absolutely brilliant at, their limitations are shown up straight away. And it's got, there's one sequence where they're all dressed as, I can't even talk about it. It's the most depressing thing I've ever heard. After each song, it resets. Oh, we've got to find those tapes. They've gone missing. And that's seen as promotion. You realise the skill that there is in Showboat or in Mary Poppins even. There's a shape to it. Roger Ebert.
Friend of the show. Gave the film friend.
1 out of 4 stars. Said the music's wonderful, because it is, it's Paul McCartney music, and calling it about as close as you can get to a non-movie, and saying this is a brilliant summation of bad musicals. The parts that do try something are the worst parts. You get that part with great musicians, Paul McCartney, Harry Nilsson, whoever it is, the Bee Gees even, just do a concert movie.
Yeah.
When they sort of say what the audience really needs is a story to carry them through, and you went, you didn't need that on the albums, just play. Stop making sense.
It's like porn films. Just do the sex scenes, guys.
Yeah, just the padding. You just go, just get to the
sex. We don't need to see how the postman got to the house. Just need to see him offer his large package.
But they do actually, these bad musicals, especially the Rockstar Vanity projects, always have the feeling of porn. What I find really depressing about them is because these guys have got money and can swing stars in. Do you want to be in a film with Paul McCartney? Ralph Richardson's in Give My Regards to Broad Street. No. Yeah. It's just a huge waste of effort when actually all you want to do is watch these people sing.
Yeah.
And I think it's the most defining thing about the achievement of a good musical is that when the songs stop, you're enjoying the story.
Yeah.
And when the story stops, you're enjoying the songs. And people who can do it really well, I think the Disney ones do that brilliantly. They're a really good Disney. You're enjoying the action and the jokes, and then they go to a song and you don't mind.
Yeah.
It's when it changes the two gears it's in, don't mind whichever one you're in. You're as happy as you can be.
Yeah.
And the feeling when you watch these musicals, oh, I'll sing in a minute, it'll be okay. Yeah. you're really, it makes it, it's hard work.
So are you picking one or both of those?
I think Give My Regards to Broad Street is worse than Son of Dracula, because Son of Dracula I excuse because everyone was pissed.
Yeah.
The only other honourable thing I'll get doing passing, by the way, is another film which is very different from that, which is a film called Begin Again.
Oh, John Carney.
John Carney's film Between Once and Sing Street, both of which I love. Yes. And Begin Again, I've decided, is now going to be my Christmas film. Because I caught it on TV last year. I do like a film where Keira Knightley's bad in it. I watch Love Actually 20 times a year. I adore watching her not be as good as people think she is. She's great in Parts of the Caribbean, but that's about it. But it's a film about a man who discovers a pop singer who's basically singing Smelly Cat in a New York bar, and he records an album with her in public places. John Carney was in the frames. He was in a band.
Yeah.
He knows The one place you don't record music is in a public space. So she's doing things like crossing the street and in a subway thing. And you go, the first thing you think is, that's not how you record a song.
Yeah.
And then you have to watch an hour and a half where they go, this is how it is. It's not. It's not. Yeah. The first thing you do is you go somewhere fucking quiet. and if you're trying to sell me that this is how, then I don't believe any of this bullshit.
Even in Once the Buskers Rent a Recording Studio. Yeah.
You go indoors.
Play outside.
The first rule of recording is close the windows. Yeah. And what I love about Begin Again is everything about it works except the central idea.
Yeah.
And all the way through it, I was watching my wife crying laughter, going, no, no. And they do the romance and the jokes and they all work. And you're going, but the central idea doesn't work. And I love the fact that even now you can make what is effectively a vanity rock movie that the central idea doesn't work. I'm glad they're still making them.
Yeah. I'm delighted that you have found a glint of sunlight in that otherwise miserable fact of life.
Landscape.
Okay, I feel like that was really purgative for you.
I feel better now.
Good.
You look 10 years younger.
Obviously, America was the birth of musical and film and cinema and all that Busby Berkeley business. Mm-hmm. And when Joseph Goebbels in Nazi Germany said, right, I need to create this wonderful propaganda to get across Hitler's charming message, he looked at all the Hollywood movies and was like, brilliant, tits, teeth, long legs, that fits perfectly with the Aryan ideal, off we go.
Lenny Riefenstahl.
Yeah.
Yeah, precisely.
Get him out, Lenny, he said.
But meanwhile, in Soviet Russia, they'd been trying to make mainstream popular propaganda films, but it just hadn't been popping because turns out the sort of the drudgery of socialism is quite hard to get across in an exciting film. Mm. So eventually they snapped and went, they broke and went, fine, we'll make a musical. So there was a Soviet film director called Sergei Eisenstein, and he went to the United States with a fellow director called Grigory Alexandrov. And they studied Hollywood filmmaking. And they came back and they made a movie called The Jolly Fellows, which is the first Soviet musical. It focused on comedy and musicals and lightness of touch, and the party officials hated it. They're like, you can't just, like, let laughter for laughter's sake is the most bourgeois thing possible.
There have to be tractor manufacturing statistics in this somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. But they said, no, we're gonna show it to Comrade Stalin and see what he thinks. And Stalin was shown it and liked it, and he gave them the go-ahead to make more musicals.
Springtime for Stalin.
Yeah, exactly. You joke about the tractor statistics, but he basically said, we will make movies for the millions, but they have to involve the message of the importance of collective labour and rags-to-riches stories.
When Corbyn gets in, it'll be like that over here. Industry, Harry Potter will be full of this.
Yeah. Yeah, but just all of the goblins that you see in Gringotts will be in every position of power.
Yeah. And the tractors turn into unicorns at midnight for some stupid fucking reason.
Stop it, let it go.
So sorry.
Welcome back to J.K. Rowling's stupid wizarding world.
Potter less, thank you.
So the first big social realist musical, which is a collection of words that shouldn't be put together, was called Circus, and it starred a woman called Yubov Orlova as an American circus performer who has to immigrate to the Soviet Union because she has a mixed-race child who she's had with a black gentleman.
Okay.
And basically, amidst all this lavish musical production, she finds love and acceptance in the Soviet Union as a place of racial tolerance.
Ooh.
It's a bold message.
Having a dig at the Americans. Yeah, yes, we're horrendous dictators, but racism, guys.
We oppress equally.
Yeah. Another one of his popular...
Discrimination doesn't discriminate.
That's definitely the name of the opening number,
isn't
it?
Yeah.
Another one called The Bright Path, which is a reworking of the fairy tale of Cinderella, but set in the Soviet Union. The moral of this story is that better life comes from hard work.
Oh, a pumpkin that turns into a vehicle is like a Soviet wet dream.
Yeah.
I know, I think this one, the pumpkin stays a pumpkin.
Yeah. And pumpkins must be pumpkins. Carriages must be carriages.
Yeah, she stays as a pumpkin, and then she goes back to the hearth and finishes cleaning it up.
Yeah.
There's virtue in hard work.
And shaking off the glass slipper is a sign of shaking off capitalist frippery.
But she's told that the pumpkin will be like this enormous award-winning pumpkin, but instead it's just a tiny little marrow on sprout wheat.
She has to queue for it.
Yeah. But there's no choreography in it, just pictures of factory machines set to music. Yeah. One other one, there's another chap called Ivan Piriev, and his most famous movie is The Cossacks of the Kuban.
The Cuban?
No, not of the Cuban.
Sort of Fandango Cossacks.
Fandango Cossacks.
My new drag name.
The film is set in the early post-war years on a kolkhoze, a collective farm, where a dashing horse breeder, Nikolai, gets acquainted with an advanced collective farmer, Dasha. Their infatuation is mutual, but the lovers, working in different farms, have to overcome the resistance of their leaders.
Oh.
It's Romeo and Juliet on a collective farm.
Amazing.
The next thing I found was going to be my suggestion until the thing that I found, which is delightfully balmy. But we're going to the 70s, and we're going to a film that directed by Ken Russell, starring Roger Daltrey.
I'm feeling something good brewing.
Yeah. This is Roger Daltrey, of course, as the star of Tommy, the rock opera. But it's not Tommy. It's Listomania.
Yay! This sounds amazing.
What is Listomania? Okay, so my brain has instantly gone, a musical about the life of Joseph Lister.
It is a musical about the life of 19th century composer Franz Liszt.
Yay!
Sorry, the Who's Roger Daltrey?
Yes!
Perfect casting.
Pinball wizard to Franz Liszt.
Derived in part from a kiss and tell book by Marie de Ajoul, who about to have an affair with Liszt.
What?
Everyone wanted this musical. Everyone was waiting
for it. Are you kidding me?
This reminds me, because I had a theory about Andrew Lloyd Webber, that his entire career was like the producers.
Yeah.
That he'd started off, he'd gone, what would lose money? And they went, what about the Bible? Okay, what about doing the Bible again? What about doing right-wing dictators? What about everyone's dressed as cats? Everyone's a train. Like the Northern Ireland Trouble. I've got to lose money somehow. And they keep accidentally being hits. And this sounds like it's come from the same thing, going, oh, no one's talking about Franz Liszt's affair. Let's make a musical of it. It's all a huge tax dodge.
Of all the people who've had affairs, here a decade after JFK and Marilyn Monroe.
This is sizzling hot.
Strap in, because this is the sanest thing I'm going to say in the next 5 minutes.
No.
So, they depict Liszt as the first classical pop star. This is this is a decade before
this is
Amadeus.
This was a big performer.
Yep. The soundtrack is composed by Rick Wakeman from Yes, obviously, and it includes synthesizer arrangements of works by Liszt and Wagner.
Yeah.
Wakeman also appears in the film as the Nordic god of thunder, Thor.
They didn't get him for the Marvel. Idiots.
Yes. There are other...
We've nailed it. We've got it down to two. We've got Chris Hemsworth and Rick Wakeman.
What do they look like with their tops on? Yeah.
There is another rock celebrity in Listomania. We've already mentioned him. It's Ringo Starr.
Yeah, of course he is. And there's the hat trick.
And Ringo Starr is playing the Pope.
The role he was born to play.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, we've had a Pope John Paul. We haven't had a George. We can't have a Ringo.
Pope Ringo the First. Rather than presenting a straightforward narrative, the film tells his life...
Oh, good.
Yeah. Through a series...
Who likes straightforward narratives? If we've learned nothing over the last hour, it's nobody.
A series of surrealistic episodes blending fact and fantasy and full of anachronisms. At the start of the film, Liszt is caught in bed with Marie de Ajoul by her husband, the Count de Ajoul. The Count then orders his staff to trap Liszt and Marie into the body of a piano, nailing it shut and leaving it on railroad tracks.
That's so Laurel and
Hardy.
What year
is this? What, this is the 1800s. So the railways were going at what, like... 10 miles an hour at this point.
Yeah, they're just
going
to nudge the piano along the track. This scene is then shown to be a flashback triggered by the camera flash of photographers backstage before one of Liszt's concerts. That's right, photographers are one of Liszt's concerts. Right.
So it's a bit like Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, sure.
Very, very like that.
Right, yeah. Then Richard Wagner appears and Liszt introduces him to a circle of colleagues, including people like Rossini, Berlioz, Chopin... At the concert, Wagner is really turned off Liszt by his crowd-pleasing showmanship at the expense of serious musicianship. Which,
to be fair, there's one thing that Wagner isn't. It's crowd-pleasing. Unless that crowd is at Nuremberg.
Yeah.
He's more crowd-pleasing.
Yeah. He gets pissed off at Liszt because Liszt shows off by adding the melody of Chopsticks to his variation. But the crowd love it. It's full of screaming girls. They can completely nuts. And Liszt uses like his reputation from this concert to proposition potentially wealthy females in the audience, including Princess Carolyn. We then go to Russia, where Liszt meets her at her court, and she begins to seduce him. In one of the weirdest scenes in the movie, bear in mind what I've said so far.
Yeah.
He experiences a hallucination where the women of Princess Carolyn's court assail him, but then becomes seduced by his music, which strokes his libido and gives him a 10-foot erection.
Is that a bassoon in your pocket? Yeah. Please to see me.
No coherent narrative, but it does have a 10-foot cock. Erection.
I'm in. Yeah. It's what he said from the next room.
The women then drag Liszt and his erection to a guillotine.
Pretends as he wants to lose first.
Yeah, exactly. Carolyn reveals that the bargain for his newfound music ability is to forfeit his life of a libertine. So then we then go to the May Uprising in Dresden.
What's this film missing? The May Uprising in Dresden.
Yeah. Wagner is now a political criminal. As Liszt tends to Wagner's wounds, Wagner secretly drugs Liszt, who passes out.
Oh.
Wagner then reveals himself to be a vampire.
Oh, good.
Wow.
With a mission to write music that will inspire new German nationalism. He then proceeds to suck Liszt's blood and compose on the piano. Before departing, Wagner leaves him his latest political pamphlet, which is obviously a Superman comic written by Friedrich Nietzsche.
What the fuck is going on?
God, holy
shit. How many days can he get out of one machina?
Yeah. What else happens in this? Liszt.
I think I'm getting the feeling it'd be quicker to tell us what doesn't happen.
Okay, other things that occur.
Yeah.
Just as a highlight, Liszt becomes an abbot.
Whilst
an abbot, he's caught in bed with a woman. And then the Pope has to explain that Wagner...
Pope Ringo explains
that Wagner has been seduced by Cosima as his wife and has begun to lead a devilish cult organised around his music. He tasks Liszt with travelling to Wagner's castle to exorcise the devil from Wagner and return him to the Christian faith, or else Liszt will be excommunicated and his music banned.
I tell you what, at least it's not restating the same stakes over and over again.
Liszt travels to Wagner's castle, where he observes a secret ritual portraying a devilish Jew raping several blonde-haired Germanic nymphs. Wagner appears with Cosima, dressed in Superman outfits,
yes,
and sings about how, and I quote, the flowering of youth of Germany was raped by the beast, and that a new messiah will soon arrive to drive out that beast. At the conclusion of the song, Cosima marches the audience, composed entirely of children, out with a Nazi salute as they chant about how they will be the master race.
Oh, wow. I love a film with a happy ending.
I feel like I've had a stroke and I can't, you know, like, you're actually just saying normal words and I'm hearing something completely different.
Can you smell burnt toast?
Yeah. Yes.
Later on, Wagner is killed and then subsequently resurrected in a Nazi ceremony as a Frankenstein Hitler wielding a machine gun guitar.
Mercy, I'll tell you where the fucking plans are. Just let me go.
Trapped, Liszt observes that as Cosima leads the Wagner Hitler to gun down the town's Jews, after which she kills Liszt by stabbing a needle through the heart of a voodoo doll. It's like this.
What?
The film concludes in heaven.
No, of course it does.
Where Liszt is reunited with the women he romanced in his life.
Where Mick Jagger plays God, presumably.
He is reunited with all these different women, and they regret their behaviour towards him and each other, and finally they live together in harmony. In the final episode, Liszt and the women decide to fly down to Earth in a spaceship to destroy Wagner Hitler, who has now ravaged Berlin. And
Wagner Franken Hitler, please get it right.
Hello, we're the Wagner Franken Hitlers. Very old family. Once Wagner Hitler is destroyed, Liszt sings that he is now fine. Peace at last.
Oh, sweet mother of Christ.
And yet...
Wow, is this not your suggestion?
Because it sounds too much fun.
Yeah.
And I found something weirder. And what I found is something that actually relates to a topic you brought up already. A film called Billy the Kid and the Green Bay's Vampire.
And the green, like a snooker playing, pool playing vampire?
I've heard of this, but I don't know anything about it. I know the title, that's about it.
It is a British musical from 1987 starring Phil Daniels from Quadrophenia film and Alan Armstrong, the brilliant Geordie actor, starring in a post-apocalyptic sci-fi subterranean snooker western.
So it's got
with
that
vampires.
Oh right, no, because it's got there's that thing after you've done Tommy and you've said you can do pub sports as the subject for a big rock opera. Bar Billiards is next.
Absolutely.
Then Jim Bowen's got the bullseye lined up.
Basically, Billy the Kid, which is Phil Daniels, he's playing a cipher of like Jimmy White, who famously in the 1980s,
it's the mid 80s, they want a snooker film.
He was the hot new thing on the circuit, Jimmy White, and obviously Alan Armstrong is the Green Bay's vampire, and that's meant to be Ray Reardon, who was the great world champion.
He was a bit vampire-y,
exactly, and that was his nickname. Billy the Kid's manager, who's called T.O., standing for The One, is a compulsive gambler who falls into debt with a psychopathic loan shark called The Wednesday Man, who offers to cancel The One's debt if he can arrange a 17-frame grudge match between Billy and the reigning world champion Maxwell Randall, who is popularly known as the Green Bay's vampire, but actually is a fucking vampire. Some of the songs from this movie include I Bite Back.
Please tell me they sing Snooper Loop.
I was about to say, did Chaz and Dave write this?
Yeah.
In which case, it's not fair, because they didn't.
They didn't, but they did write a song. There is a song in it called Snooker, So Much More Than Just a Game. There's a lot of Thatcherist criticism running through it, because obviously snooker's a very working class man sport.
Brilliant.
Billiards Elliot.
Lads.
Amazing.
Lads, these are coming out of the top drawer. This is
very good.
But the film, like, it is. The songs are so prosaically awful because you got the big 80s hair and people trying to sing passionately about snooker. Snooker, it's only a game. It's more than just a game.
Yeah, but I mean, chess worked-ish.
Ish. Oh, good point.
But I think that's the problem with musicals is that if while you're making it, someone went, hang on, guys, this is stupid. They can point to the vast number of successful musicals that were also fucking stupid. Yeah, exactly.
All right, lads, today we're going to start writing Mahjong, the musical. The bit that, like,
Mahjong, your song, everyone's song.
the denouement is ridiculous because the kid has to pot the final black in a sort of callback to the Dennis Taylor, Steve Davis final of 1985, and he hits it off 10 different cushions. Yep. It tries to go into the final pocket, at which point it just reveal that the vampire is actually a vampire, and Alan Armstrong's eyes glow white and he levitates the black ball over the pocket, at which point Billy the Kid pulls out a revolver and shoots the black ball into the pocket and everyone goes wild with his victory.
This sounds brilliant.
I'm kind of in.
All I'm saying with this musical is it sounds like the songs are letting it down on the rest of it. It's just amazing.
You will probably disagree with yourself when you watch some of Billy the Kid and the Green Bay's Vampire,
right?
Because it is, you know, when you were a kid in art class and you just wondered, I wonder what will happen if I mix together every single colour. Well, they've done that with every single colour of ball on the snooker table and made a
brown.
Brown.
Giant brown. Shit.
They made brown shit brown.
They have made a shit brown musical. Yeah. Our suggestions are Barry's suggestion of the Beatles baiting but Beatle free Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Joel's suggestion of the Beatles containing Give My Regards to Broad Street, and my suggestion of the hit snooker western vampire Thatcherist criticism crossover Billy the Kid and the Green Bay's Vampire. Lads, this is up there with the weirdest hour and a half of my life. And I really don't know what to suggest. Give My Regards to Broad Street.
I can't talk about it. What's amazing is I think it's the perfect example of someone saying, hey, how hard can it be? And the answer is really fucking hard.
I think that although yours and mine, Barry, hit the notes of joyously heroic failure, I think that we'd enjoy watching them.
Probably.
Yeah, whereas, as Joel has attested, you stopped watching a bad movie to watch an even worse movie.
As in, I would, honestly, and halfway through Give My Regards to Broad Street, I just thought, I don't think I'm ever going to finish this. It's an hour and a half long, and I'm still at 15 minutes short because I thought being Paul McCartney is the most boring job in the world. And he's gone, you know what they did wrong with the Magical Mystery Tour? They put me in that yellow... Well, they did wrong with the Yellow Submarine. They put me in that Yellow Submarine fighting monsters under the sea. I'll show people what you could really do with my music.
Well, I'll tell you what's great. Buying the supplies to stock a submarine.
Yeah, what it is, it's beige submarine.
Yeah. So, yeah, your film is grey, mine is brown, and yours blinding vermilion. So we give in. So in it goes. Give my regards to Broad Street as our select from the worst musical film ever. Before we go, the world's worst news of the week, we go to Houston in Texas, where Houston City Council have prevented what was billed as the first brothel in the United States to be equipped with sex dolls from opening in the city. The reason they've done this, basically, customers want to be able to buy adult love dolls and rent them for use in their own private rooms. Yeah. Why you wouldn't just buy one and take it home to your own bedroom is beyond me. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner told reporters, you cannot engage in sexual activities with any inanimate object at the business. The founder of Kinky's Dolls, Yuval Gavriel, said he was talking to his lawyers about suing the city over its decision. We are investigating our options, he said in a telephone interview. Wondering what he's doing at the other end of the telephone.
Can we Skype
line.
You? No.
So sad news for all lovers of wipe keen plastic dolls. Yeah. Before we go, Joel, where can our listeners find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Probably at the moment the easiest thing to find us, probably doing is a thing called Rule of Three, which is available. You can find me on Twitter at Rule of Three Pod, which is where we talk to comedians, writers, producers, people who work in comedy about their favourite comedy thing, their favourite funny thing. We're halfway through the second series at the moment. We've just had Sue Perkins talking about Spinal Tap, which was delightful. And surprising.
Why wouldn't you do that for an hour?
Yeah, and it's just they're very enjoyable because it's people just talking about things they love. You can find us there, and that's, I recommend listening to some people being happy about things.
Oh, delightful. Well, we're all off to listen to a synth-pop grime crossover of The Dark Side of the Moon, Yay! Starring the Human League and Stormzy. Until next time.
Bye!